Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
No, sorry, take two. This program has been sponsored by the Hearst Ranch. At Hearst Ranch, ranch manager Cliff Garrison describes their philosophy. Raising cattle on grass is both an ancient practice and one that is standard in much of the modern world. Sometimes the old ways are the right ways. We believe that our methodology is the right one for us. For more information on their premium grass-fed beef, visit HearstRanch.com.
Hello, Greenhorns. This is Severin. This is Greenhorn Radio. Radio by young farmers, for young farmers, about young farmers. In the team of young farmers, I am joined by Bob St. Peter from Maine, in Sedgwick, Maine, down east. Are you there, Bob?
I'm here, Severin. Hello.
You're here. Talk loud, because sometimes it's hard to hear.
Okay.
So our topic for today is food sovereignty and how community self-reliance and teamwork play into a more resilient agricultural economy. Could you tell us just a little bit about down east Maine, Bob? What's the land like where it hits the ocean?
Well, in some places it's quite rocky. We have a lot of native blueberries, blueberry ground, particularly as you head further down east, north and east of where we are, which ironically is called down east, but that's just the way it goes. Where I live in western Hancock County, we have patches of some really good soil. We have patches of some very excellent soil. There's a particular corridor that runs into Blue Hill, and that has been actively preserved and conserved by local land trusts and farming organizations. And there's a number of our more prosperous farms are up on that ridge and doing very well. We have lots of woodlands and forest, and this is a place where you can be at the ocean 1 minute and in the deep forest within an hour. So we've got a very unique ecosystem here, and it's a beautiful place to live and farm.
And you've been there farming for how long? Was farming first, or did you start in organizing?
Well, they actually kind of co-evolved. I spent 3 summers after high school working in the area, and ended up coming back through a different route in my mid-20s, and I've been here for about 11 years now, bouncing around different areas of different towns in the community, trying to find a permanent spot. But I started when we moved here, had a little garden, and that garden has grown every year since. And now I farm about 3-4 acres. I've got some animals, raised some crops. I've started a small seed farm that keeps me pretty busy. So I've been, kind of the activism, I think, and the organizing work co-evolved with the farming, in part because my desire to be a farmer and live off the land has necessitated being involved in the organizing and the political work that needs to happen to make it so more of us can do that work.
I'm sorry, I keep pushing mute so that it will be nice and quiet. So in that sense, you're part of this tribe of people that I get to hang out with a lot who are hybrid farmer organizers. Mm-hmm. Facilitating the rebuilding or the building of a new economy inside the shell of the old one, and thinking in those terms. What are the ways in which your community is working together in unusual ways?
Well, I think in the most unusual way would be on the organizing side of things. The farmers supporting each other, the young farmers helping each other out, that all goes on here, and that goes on in a lot of communities, and it's a necessity, really, for us to make it. We got to help each other out. But out of those relationships has formed a really cohesive group of people who are looking at our local food economy, our local food system, as a place of a lot of opportunity, economically, socially, culturally, and we are actively working on putting pieces back together, looking at co-ops for farm inputs like grain and hay, looking at ways that we can help each other market products that we sell through local buying clubs, through local businesses. And we're also dealing with some of the regulatory issues facing small farmers and particularly those of us who are trying to do small, diverse farming, doing on-farm processing, doing on-farm value-added, whether that's meat or dairy or prepared foods. And we're having some difficulty, I guess that would be a bit of an understatement, with our State Department of Agriculture on some of these issues. And we've had differences of opinion on what are scale-appropriate rules and regulations, and have really met some significant resistance from our State Department of Agriculture. And after the Department of Agriculture drafted rules for an on-farm poultry processing exemption that banned outdoor open-air processing, we decided as a community here to pass some of our own local rules and regulations regarding the direct sale of farm products and food products in our community. So back in March, my town passed the Local Food and Community Self-Governance Ordinance, which is a municipal ordinance that exempts direct sales from state and federal license and inspection requirements. That exemption extends to community suppers, bake sales, grange suppers, church suppers, those sorts of things, where people are preparing foods in their home and bringing them for sale as part of a benefit or as part of a fundraiser of some kind. And so my town did that in March. Four other towns, in Maine have since passed that ordinance. It looks like there are other towns in Maine where this is going to be coming up for a vote at their town meeting later this year. And in November, one of our farmers in an ordinance-protected town of Blue Hill, a man named Dan Brown, was sued by the state of Maine for operating a retail food establishment, meaning a farm stand, and selling milk without proper licenses. So this is working its way through the courts. The state has told us that this is not a direct challenge to the ordinance because they don't believe that the ordinance is valid and that state law preempts the municipal authority to create such ordinances. And so they're going after Dan personally, but those of us behind or involved in the ordinance effort understand that if Dan is required to get licenses, then all the rest of us are required to get licenses, and therefore this is a direct challenge to our ordinance and our municipal authority.
So obviously milk is a more controversial product than, say, bread. But what's at stake in terms of the rights of communities to be in charge of their own regulatory framework? What's the kind of political context of a more decentralized regulatory framework?
Well, what we included in our ordinance really is the way that rural communities have been feeding themselves for a very, very long time. People producing food on their farm, whether it's milk or meat or vegetables, and offering for sale to their neighbors, to their community, through their farm stand or through a farmer's market, or through local businesses, and that's an important part of the local economy. And the money that the wealth that gets created on the farm, or in the farmhouse kitchen, and that stays in the community, is really an important part of having a thriving local economy. So the ability to be able to produce and sell in your community and trade goods and services is really important. And that, you know, that economic activity then serves to, you know, the broader purpose of cohesing, or I don't know if that's a word, but bringing together the community socially and, you know, in times of need and all the rest. So for us, you know, we look at what we had as a community, say, 60, 70, 80 years ago, when we had, you know, a number of dairy farms. We had a creamery in the county. We had a milling. We had grist mills here. We had, you know, more fish processing facilities. And most of this, if not all of this, is now gone. And it's been replaced with stores that's full of food that is imported from all around the world, that comes in our communities as a result of a global economy that suppresses prices, pushes down the price of food, and essentially undercuts us here in our community, trying to sell to our neighbors. So the small farms
in your community are not selling to supermarkets, and the supermarket economy is therefore been decoupled from the local food production economy.
By and large, yeah. You know, I was just having this conversation an hour ago with somebody who works on fisheries issues, and we were both complaining that in our local community, where we have farms and we have fisheries, how little local food is available in the local grocery stores, and particularly all these little gas station convenience stores that we have dotted all over our rural landscape. You know, these little rural bodegas where you can stop in and get some fast food or you know, a bag of chips and maybe an apple or something if they're selling it. But yeah, for the most part, as you said, those two economies have been decoupled, and they, with the exception of a few seasonal exceptions, that's pretty much how it works. Is that the farm economy operates through different channels than the grocery store economy.
And the supermarket economy is closely linked to the super duper super agribusiness economy. And you're on YouTube, famous now for having stood outside of the hearing on last Tuesday, for bringing up another important topic, and that is the rules of the game in the super duper agribusiness world. Again, not a harmonious coexistence with the needs of small farmers. Could you tell us about that?
Well, yeah. You know, over the last 60, 70 years, as the production capacity has been undermined in our communities, there has been a co-evolving regulatory framework that has served to take more power from local communities and place it in further and further away institutions. So for us, as an example, when we go to the State Department of Agriculture and ask for a rule that allows us to process a few hundred chickens in our backyards, open air, and sell it, they tell us that they can't do that for us because the USDA controls the funding for Maine's meat inspection program, and they're concerned that if we allow rules that they interpret to be less strict than what the USDA requires, and the USDA will stop sending Maine that money, and they'll even go so far as to shut down Maine's meat inspection program. And they've said this publicly. You know, so when we go to our Department of Agriculture and ask for them to stand up for our interests as small farmers, they tell us we can't. It happens at the USDA. And I've been to the USDA, and I've been to meetings at the USDA. It's a very large facility with lots of different people, and you don't have the same kind of access that you do in your state Department of Agriculture. You know, so it becomes very difficult to advocate for scale-appropriate regulations outside of, I guess in our case, outside of our own communities.
So in that sense, the context, the scale of the institution has a lot to do with how receptive it is, how reactive it can be to the needs of its constituents. And furthermore, that especially within the USDA, there are conflicting views on, you know, the direction of American agriculture. And so yeah. while on one hand we hear that we need 100,000 new farmers, there are simultaneous to that moves being made and decisions being taken that, well, have a lot to do with supporting a kind of production system that's reducing the numbers of new farm enterprises and, in fact, serving to concentrate farm productions, farm businesses, in an effort to increase exports and succeed in that sphere.
Right.
Tell me about the kind of protection that is needed that you were discussing when you drove all the way down to New York City. What were you looking for?
Well, when I went there, I was there as a member of two of the plaintiff organizations, MOFCA and Fedco Seeds, also as a seed grower, and as a proponent of food sovereignty and reducing the influence of corporations like Monsanto over the rulemaking system. We're at a point where those of us who are left. You know, either those of us who are left or those of us who, you know, the young farmers who feel like, you know, our society has sold us a bill of goods and that the American dream is not really what we were promised and that a farm life, rural life, a life as a food producer is actually a really good life. And, you know, there aren't a whole lot of us in that boat yet. And there are fewer, I think, who are hanging on, trying to make it and pass it on to their kids, that, you know, we're going to have to figure out a way to reverse the trend of authority from our communities. You know, so whether that community, in my case, is a municipality, or whether that community is a neighborhood, or whether that, you know, is a county, you know, the places where we interact with each other are the places where we need to build strength as a community so that we can reverse this trend. Because the trend has been to really do away with us. And that, you know, that's been the unfortunate consequence of U.S. agricultural policy, stated very explicitly in the early 70s as get big or get out. A lot of people got big, a lot more got out. And so in order to reverse the flow of power through the institutions, which are coming from the corporations and from their lobbyists, who then, you know, impress upon legislators to write rules that work for them. You know, we have to figure out what it is we want to be able to articulate it and to be able to do that in places where we can be free, literally free from corporate intervention. Like in my town meeting in Maine, a multinational corporation, a lobbyist from one of those corporations, is not allowed to speak at my meeting, at our town meeting, because this is a matter for our town. There's no other place that I know of that has that kind of power. We go to the state legislature to testify before the ag hearing, and there are lobbyists from Monsanto or Dow or depending on whatever the issue is. And they're there essentially on equal footing with the rest of us. And I personally don't think that's fair. So, you know, I think as communities we've got to figure out our answers to our problems and I think communities having these discussions, you know, this is where we're really going to be able to articulate a vision for where we want to go. And then it's a matter of pushing on the mechanisms that make it happen from the bottom up.
So you're talking some strong self-determination here. Those who are listening may have questions about how they could get involved in Food for Maine's future and events that you may be leading, workshops, this continuing action in the court case. Give us some leads on where to start clicking if we're interested to become at least on the mailing list of the activities you're involved with.
Yeah, well, you can start it at Food for Maine's Futures website, and that's savingseeds.wordpress.com. You can download the most recent issue of Saving Seeds, which is a newspaper that we print 2-3 times a year. It has a lot of background information on the lawsuit regarding Dan Brown and the local food ordinance the five main towns have passed. If you're on Facebook, and I imagine most of your listeners are, we have a We Are Farmer Brown page where there's a running dialogue with people who are involved in the political organizing and the community organizing aspect of all this. A lot of really good information flowing through there. Food for Maine's Future also has a Facebook page, and we have a lot of postings from the work we're doing and support for our allies and our partner organizations. So those are three places. And one other website, localfoodlocalrules.org, is a website that was set up to hold and compile a lot of the background information as well with the Farmer Brown lawsuit.
So the upcoming, thank you, Bob, very much. The upcoming events in Greenhorn's World are on Saturday, this coming Saturday, February 11th, at the Brower Center in Berkeley, California. We'll be screening the first two episodes of my new film series, which are web films, short 10-minute films on the topic of land opportunity and cracking the nut around changing the system. Practical way to come and get involved is to join us at 5. Oh, I guess there's drinks at 4 p.m. at the Brower Center. You can read about it at the Brower Center or online at our blog. There's so many events scheduled this year, it'd be terrible for me to start listing them off. So I hope that you are already on our listserv and you'll get the e-blast today to write down on your calendar all the things and start getting your own events planning for this coming season, which February is always a crazy month. So tuck up your tail and thank you all. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Severin.